Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Hank.
Oh, try it again. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Hank.
There you go.
Hey, I thought we were adding in there a couple more, like I'm pulling more adjectives into my name, like feminist, marcher, social advocate.
I thought those were just one-time things dealing with the topic of the show.
Well, I don't know. Now I'm feeling like I want to broaden my reach of things that I tapped into. But I'll have to think about it. Maybe something will come up today's show also. Social, not critic, but I don't know what the word would be. Curious explorer of the human condition. Maybe that will throw in there. It might be not. It won't roll off your tongue as easily.
See. Well, yeah.
there always is that challenge. But for today's show, you know, whatever adjective gets thrown in there, I don't generally do interviews as part of the show, as you know. It's just not kind of the style of the show. But every now and then, I'll meet someone whose story is so compelling or I find them so interesting that I really want to share their story with you and really introduce them to others, because if I find them fascinating, I would imagine that other people will too. And because as a therapist, you know, I'm really interested in how we go about finding ourselves in wherever our lives lead us, how we get to this place in our life. How do you end up living where you live or doing the work that you do or being with the people that you're with? You know, how do we find ourselves in these different places in our life? And, you know, did we maneuver ourselves into that position? You know, did we take the reins and kind of have a vision and march our way through there? Or did we just kind of sit back and allow the life journey to unfold as it was going to unfold, and then surprised where we ended up? Or was there kind of a blend of having this idea of who we were and wanting to pursue those passions that we had and following opportunities, and then eventually finding ourselves in a place that felt meaningful? Because you know that one of the main tenets of mental health is meaningful work, and also giving back to the community is another tenet. And the third one is finding ourselves in deeply connected relationships. And so those three things, you know, if they are the tenets of good mental health, those are the things that we strive for, then part of our journey to getting to that place are all of the twists and turns our life took to get us to that place of good mental health. And if we haven't found ourselves in a place of meaningful work or lacking in those deep connected relationships or feeling like we have a purpose or are giving back to our community, then looking back on our life's journey and looking at places where we might have twisted when we should have turned, or, you know, that we should have moved forward instead of falling back, to revisit some of those parts of our journey can sometimes help us to kind of reestablish our mission or our purpose or our assignment or our way in the world, and to try to work towards finding ourselves in meaningful work. So yesterday in class, there was a presentation. I teach a class in the introduction to the counseling profession. And there was a presentation done in our class by the group Restorative Partners. And the young woman who came in to represent the program talked a little bit about how she ended up working for Restorative Partners. And her story leading up to finding herself in this place was such a great example of trusting yourself and trusting the process and being true to who you are, and then finding yourself in a place that really gives your life a sense of wholeness. So I want to welcome Olivia Lopez to the show. And Olivia is the in-custody program director for Restorative Partners, which briefly is a nonprofit organization that helps heal all of those impacted by crime, utilizing the principles of restorative justice. And if that was a mouthful that you weren't really following, that's okay, because Olivia is also going to fill you in on Restorative Partners in the program and what they do in the community, as well as talking about herself, which I know the more I keep saying this, the more she's saying, I don't want to talk about myself the whole time. It's all right. We will ease you through it. But also in the presentation and listening to the principles of restorative justice and how they work to bring healing to the victims and the offenders, but also to the community that's involved whenever a crime occurs. I was thinking about the correlation between the goals of restorative justice and how we might utilize those same goals or principles in trying to heal the divide within our political communities or, you know, in our social communities, because of what has occurred with the election and a lot of people feeling very hurt and wounded on both sides, whether you're a Democrat or Republican. People are feeling shocked at the depth of emotion that they're experiencing and feeling like they have been hurt and wounded and traumatized by others in the community that they have counted on to have their back, to be supportive, to build this place that we all care so much about. And so I wonder if we can utilize some of these tools of restorative justice that we're going to talk about today in an attempt to bring some healing. And then pushing it even further, how do these tools of restorative justice also apply to conflicts within the family? And how could we apply these principles to helping to heal some of the huge divides and conflict in families? So this is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you can be part of the conversation by giving us a call at 805-781-3875. We'll open up the phone lines in a bit to hear your thoughts on these ideas. You can also be part of the show by joining us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. And you can listen to our previous shows by visiting kcbx.org under the News Talk tab. All of our shows from the last few years are there for your listening pleasure. And you can subscribe to our show. You can podcast on your device to listen anytime you'd like by visiting iTunes and by searching A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And then you'll be able to listen at your leisure and keep them if you like. So here we are. Welcome,
hello.
Olivia.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And this was so last minute, so I just really appreciate you being willing to kind of jump in here and go with the flow wherever I might lead you.
I'm instantly regretting it.
That's all right. I promise you, it may not be painless, but hopefully it'll feel comfortable.
I don't think I quite realized what I signed up for until I pulled up.
Well, you have a great spirit, and I think that's why I knew that she would be a good fit for this. But Olivia, when I introduced you, I said that, you know, your story yesterday in class was compelling, how you found yourself doing this work with Restorative Partners. And so I'm hoping you'll start off just talking about your journey. Who is Olivia and how did you end up? And people can't see you, so they don't realize that you're a young woman.
Can I guess? Yes.
Like 32?
Oh, way younger, actually. I'm 26.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I, with all the life experience you had, I imagine you had to be a little in your 30s. So at 26, how did you find yourself here?
Well, I think it goes back 26 years, plus okay. Maybe 9 months behind that, too, and maybe longer. I guess I always say, I think this started with my adoption, my own adoption, and just kind of trying to understand what happens when people are resettled or kind of reshuffled or moved out of the box that you thought you could check them and put them in at birth. And so I think that a lot of my inquiry into human suffering and into kind of human relationships and community building and how you find or recreate or build community where there potentially isn't or where it's been broken down comes from that initial kind of loss and resettlement process for myself and my own suffering in that and trying to kind of seek that in another or seek my belonging in other spaces and kind of create that for myself. So I would say it starts way back there.
And were you adopted at birth then?
Yeah, I was only when I was born, I was put into foster care for a month, and then I was adopted immediately to my parents here in San Luis Obispo. Yeah, so it was just a month. But I was on my own.
And so you grew up here.
Mm-hmm. I grew up here. I went to San Luis Obispo High School and Laguna Middle School and Sinsheimer Elementary. And before that, the Montessori School just across the road here. So I had a very privileged and fortunate upbringing. My parents, my dad's an electrician, and my mom teaches adults with developmental disabilities. And she's an artist and an advocate. So That was kind of my my upbringing. And my sister as well is adopted, but she's adopted from Honduras. And so that international aspect for me also was, I grew up thinking and being told we were both adopted and kind of thinking that meant the same thing. But as we grew, I think we both really started to understand that my position was really different. I was adopted from one white family to another, from one American family to another, one English-speaking family to another. And she really lost a lot more in the fire, I would say, in some ways. So, yeah. And then I, after I graduated from high school, I went to college down in Claremont. So it's east of LA, the Scripps College. It's a women's college down there.
Part of the whole Claremont Colleges system, which a lot of people overlook as being one of the best college systems in the United States.
Yeah, and I often get asked if it was a community college, which I've yeah, sure. Nobody knows what it is.
No.
And that was interesting because, you know, I didn't choose it for being the women's college. I actually kind of chose it in spite of that. And when I left there, it was absolutely the reason why I had gone there. That community, having that opportunity to be in an all-female space and to build female connections was, has been unparalleled in my life since then.
So you didn't go in search of going to an all-women's college. So then
no.
Why did you think you were choosing Scripps before you went?
Well, it sort of sounds weird and airy-fairy, but I love my family and I wanted to be somewhat near. And we went all over Southern California looking at schools, and I walked on Scripps campus and I thought, nope, this is it. This is home. And I don't often feel that, and I search for it kind of vehemently. So it was sort of a, this is it. This, I can do this. This is where I'm supposed to be. I got waitlisted at first, and I remember getting the letter and I was like, that's okay. I'm getting my acceptance soon. So
you had
it'll
no
get
doubt.
There. Yeah. I was like, we'll get there. So so I got there and went there. And it was there that I got to study abroad for the first time. And it's partially why I chose the school as well, because they pay for people to go abroad. It's part of the tuition. It's not extra. So I decided to base my whole major around this junior year abroad. And the first year, or the first semester, was spent in Senegal in West Africa, predominantly in the capital. And then I went to Peru and spent most of my time in Cusco and in Lima, in the capital there, for a second semester. And when I was in Peru, I had an opportunity to do an independent research project on my own. That's why I was spending the month in Lima by myself doing this project. And I really wanted to understand, going back to kind of adoption and resettlement and loss and community, and when harm kind of ruptures the web of our relationships, I wanted to see a lot of times in the global south when there's a human or man-made or I guess natural disaster, any disaster in the community, a lot of times there's a governmental response to send children away to the global north. So there's a lot of, you can see it in Guatemala, Honduras, China, South Korea, all over Ethiopia. And you can also see countries shutting down those responses when they start to get abused and people start to get trafficked, or it's, they start to really lose a lot of their young population. And so I wanted to understand if Peru had used that response during their internal war between 1980 and 2000. To see if these kids that were getting kind of their lives, the webs were getting disrupted during the war, if the government had chosen to send away in mass numbers children. And I found that they had pursued, Peru, the government had pursued a Truth and Reconciliation Commission at the end of the war, and that this part that referred to children and their condition within the war and what had happened was really, really minimal. And all of the governmental agencies and nonprofits and foreign investment had come in and responded to the needs of the community based on the recommendations made in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Well, kids were really not present in that. And so so often I found that people said, we don't know what happened to kids from that time period. We don't know where they are. We don't know what the response was. Obviously, informal ways of adopting and kind of resettling kids was certainly happening, but they don't have documentation for that. So
they thought they were taking the steps to heal the community, but in these meetings, they didn't have representation for the children.
Right. And so then this mass, you know, publication, this Truth and Reconciliation document that came out of that and was a community's attempt to heal the entire community was lacking in the child's, you know, the child's condition or what had happened to the children from that war. So I found it wasn't the response, basically. But what it did lead me to was working with a theater collective there that was working a lot on alternative mediums for individual and collective remembrance and healing. And for me, it struck something huge and personal. I'll never forget the, I was in Peru and Lima, and I was at the theater collective, and I thought I was going to study somebody else's story. But of course, there I was, and there my story was all over it and all in it. And this man who was an actor and head of the theater collective asked me to kind of go into that experience of losing your home and losing your belonging, losing your community, something that might happen for a child during the war. So he had me walking through this room and kind of imagining my home growing up and really imagining all the spaces and all the sounds, all the smells, all the colors. Being in my home. And then he clapped really loudly and said, now imagine it's all gone. And he walked me through that experience of imagining that everything that I had just kind of pulled up from my upbringing had disappeared. And it sounds sort of simple and sort of like, how could that really, you know,
it couldn't be that easy.
No, but it was, I broke down into tears. It was this really big shift for me and kind of looking at how individually we're harmed by these kind of collective experiences and then also how our individual traumas kind of inform the collective as well. So that kind of created a big shift for me and looking at how do we individually, how do we suffer? How does our suffering connect us to one another? And then how do we heal alone and together? And that's what took me actually to Rwanda. So I applied after.
And I'm going to back you up.
Yeah.
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest is Olivia Lopez. She is the in-custody program director for Restorative Partners. And I invited her in today to tell her story, which she's doing beautifully, of how she found herself as a young woman from San Luis Obispo to being in this work, this meaningful work that she's doing today. And you talked about, you know, choosing scripts because of the study abroad, and you did part of it in Senegal and part of it in Peru. But you didn't, what was the major that you were pursuing that led you to these places?
Well, like I said, I sort of formed my major around that abroad experience. So I chose foreign languages so I could communicate while I was in those countries, right? And Africana studies, which ended up being a focus on Africa, but also the diaspora and actually racism in the U.S.
So once you had this epiphany for yourself, a personal awakening in your work in Peru, then what was the trip to Rwanda? What inspired that? Was that while you were still in school?
Yeah. So it came to my senior year, writing my thesis, pulling my hair out. senior year of college, there's all these opportunities and all these these efforts to push us along the path. And a friend of mine was applying for a Fulbright, and I had already applied to another grant, and I didn't get it, and I just thought, well, whatever. So the night before, I wrote the application, and I got it, and I was sent to Rwanda through that. So
it's a Fulbright fellowship.
Mm-hmm. It was an ETA, which is an English teaching assistantship, so part of it is teaching English at a university, and then the other part is you have to propose a research project, and I proposed in line with what I was working on in Peru.
And so what did that look like for you in Rwanda?
Well, it looked like living in a convent with nuns out in a rural village and with a lot of people from the community who had nowhere else to go. And another interesting kind of cross-section of what I was looking at already, to be living in that community and trying to be a part of it.
But displaced from your original home.
Right. So I'm already, you know, I'm totally out of fish out of water. And then living in a community of other people who within their own community are fish out of water, and within a religious community that wasn't my own, and it was just a really fascinating kind of going to Catholic Mass in Kinyarwanda every Thursday morning at my house was an interesting experience. But and I was teaching at the university across the road there. It's just a rural village out in the east of the country. It's a really small country, and it was a resettlement community. And so I ended up teaching part-time, but also going all over the country trying to understand, again, looking at localized responses to what had gone on with the genocide there. And then in the years following, I was there in the 19th year. After the genocide, so 19th kind of remembrance year. And I went to all sorts of different community groups from, I think the most memorable for me was a woman, a widower, and a rape victim, and her daughter likewise was a rape victim. And she'd started her own, what I can only describe as like AA or NA for survivors of war and of rape and genocide. And it was a bunch of women who walked from all over the hills every month to meet together and to share what was going on for them in their lives. And they could share it in any way they wanted, which was another, I just keep finding in other communities, the willingness to express our suffering and express our lives, our stories in other medium, not just not just words, not just the written word, or not just in conversation. So like a woman stood up and I was sure she was just going to start speaking, and it got really silent. And then she just started singing, and she sang what was going on for her. And then she sat down, and that was it.
And so it sounds like you keep finding this theme of people wanting to find community, even when they're separated from their original home or their original group, that they then in turn go to find community in other ways to build it, that there's something innately healing, or there's an innate drive in us as humans to want to be with others, to share our experience as humans and our suffering and our pain. Because I think a lot of the common thought is that when people are hurting, that they retreat and kind of try to lick their wounds and get better. But really what we search on a deep primal level is to come together and try to heal as a whole. So how did this inform you going forward then, this experience in Rwanda?
Well, I think one thing, kind of like you said, I realized I was so much more connected to what was happening there than I had thought. I thought, you know, I studied post-genocide society in school, or I studied conflict, and I thought, oh, those people over there are dealing with that. So that's interesting. And then I got there and I thought, oh, gosh, those people are me. And I'm absolutely I have every bit of kind of moral obligation and responsibility to understand and listen to this and to respond as any person living in this community does, and that it can happen anywhere, anytime, as I unfortunately think that we're seeing some of, that there's kind of the rumblings of this kind of pain in any society at any time. And so I think that's how it kind of informed my next steps, was realizing that it wasn't a Rwandan issue or a German issue or a Bosnian issue, that this is a human thing. When we suffer, we tend to, it seems, cause suffering for others. And when we suffer, we also likewise can seek the suffering of others to heal, I think. I mean, it seems to me that I kept finding that in other people's suffering, I felt bonded. And other people's pain is really where I felt like we were finding our connection to each other, refinding each other.
In a deeper way, because we talk about trying to find commonalities and, you know, things that we like, the same food or the same music, or, but really that depth of connection, that thing we talk about in mental health, that meaningful sense of connection, comes from having suffered in such a deep space that you can only relate to someone who suffered in that same deep space. And that was a Carl Jung philosophy, that we could only, you know, understand pain to the depth of our own wounding.
Right. Or where we're willing to be vulnerable with ourselves and others. I think that's, yeah, that seems like, unless I was willing to say, yeah, me too, to the stories I was hearing and to really go there as well, then I wasn't getting anywhere.
So you couldn't remain in that position of student looking from the outside.
Unfortunately.
Which we all like to think, well, we'll just be observers. But you had to take yourself into that experience. So how did you bring that experience back home then?
Well, I think I also found that while I am connected absolutely to what's going on in Rwanda, or to, you know, any place in the world at any time, I think that I also felt a real obligation to my home space and to the fact that I think that irregardless of the potential for connection wherever I go, that I am most effective in my own backyard, because my ability, I think, to tap into that dark place, like you're saying, is more readily available in some ways to the dark place of my neighbor. So I think that I sort of felt like I can only be so effective in Rwanda, and then a Rwandan person will always be more effective, and they know their needs. And so I wanted to come back here and figure out what are my needs and what are the needs of my community in my space, and how can I be of service to that and sit in that kind of mutuality of our own pain right here at home. So I think that's what brought me back. And I studied, I actually went to the yoga center and did a yoga training. That's what brought me back. I thought, gosh, if I'm going to be in the middle of Sudan, or if I'm going to be, you know, in San Luis doing this work, I've got to be able to take care of myself. Mm-hmm. And so I became a yoga teacher and started volunteer teaching at the jail, out of the San Luis Obispo County Jail. And that's through Restorative Partners. That's how I kind of got involved originally.
So you didn't have the intention of, oh, I'm going to go back and I'm going to join this group, Restorative Partners. It was, again, one of those things where you continued staying on your path, right? Followed your truth or your story, and it opened these doors.
Right. It was a real, that exact kind of just tumbled into it. And I even, you know, I tried to leave at one point. I was like, oh, I'm done volunteering. Here I go. And that's actually when I got, 2 days before I left, I'd shaved my head. I was going to an ashram. My boss, Sister Teresa, our executive director, called me and said, actually, I need a program director. Can you come on back? And so it was kind of like a, you can't open the door that you think needs opening because there's one right in front of you.
Absolutely. You're listening to Olivia Lopez. She is my guest today, the in-custody program director for Restorative Partners here in San Luis Obispo County. And this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You're listening to Public Radio KCBX. And if you have a comment or question, our number is 805-781-3875. And so that brings us to the story of Restorative Partners. And can you tell, you know, what is Restorative Partners and what's the history of this program?
Yeah. So Restorative Partners, we're a 501c3. We're a nonprofit. And we were started by Sister Teresa Harpin, our executive director, and with a Cal Poly volunteer and with the partnership and support and communication of the probation department and the sheriff's department through Captain Michelle Cole, and then at the time the chief probation officer Gary Gerolman. And so they started it together, really at a table and in and out, as I understand the story. So again, another kind of tumbling into something story. And it started really just with Sister and a handful of volunteers bringing yoga and meditation and spiritual counseling into the jail and the juvenile hall as a response to the State Realignment Act, AB 109, which rehoused a lot of people from state prisons into our jail, into our county-level jail. And so what happened was the facility turned from being kind of an in-and-out, if you will, as well, a revolving door place or sort of a transit center, to being a place that actually housed people for long term. And the requirements of that necessitates programming and other opportunities for healing and growth and learning and for time spent to be time spent in a healing way or a productive way rather than just sitting in the county jail for years.
So what was the inspiration to even bring in mindfulness or yoga into the jail or the county jail or to the juvenile facilities? What was the hope that these services would do?
Well, I think twofold, as I understand it, and because it's still our work. One is to provide an opportunity, like I said, an interruption in some ways, but an opportunity really to give people the chance to heal, to take their own, to look at their story, like we're looking at mine, for example, and see where can I kind of forgive myself and figure out what I want to do different moving forward. And then I think the real kind of crux of Restorative Partners is come one, come all, we bring the community, and there's that mutuality again of we belong to one another. And if you're suffering and I'm suffering and we can figure that out together and we can rebuild that web together, that we're going to innately seek it. But what if we sought it in one another in this space? So to bring, we're entirely volunteer run besides our small staff. So, you know, over 200 volunteers are providing all of these programs. We have over 30 between the two facilities now, the jail and the juvenile hall. And to bring community members from all corners of our community who've been affected in one way or another, or who haven't been, but who are you know, interested and willing to reconnect with our other community members and walk forward. That's, I think, the kind of second part. So not only providing that mindfulness opportunity, but to do it in kinship, so that you and I are practicing together and reminding each other that while you're practicing, I also am practicing. While you're hurting, I also am hurting. While you're filled with joy, I also have that experience.
So if I understand it with the restorative partner, the idea of restorative justice is that instead of separating out the offender from the victim and housing the offender in a space that's separate from community, the hope is that we bring offenders and victims together for mutual understanding and an opportunity for reconciliation. If possible, and also to create, as you keep beautifully saying, this idea of community, that there are no others or those who are separate, that we're all one community. And if the offenders are hurting and in pain, then no matter how much healing we do, as victims, it's never going to be a full healing if there is still a part of our community that suffers. Am I on track at all?
Yeah, I think so. And, I restorative justice is actually a very victim-centered approach. And so I think that's kind of an interesting part to look at when we talk about restorative partners. The majority of our work thus far has been with what people would call the offender population. So we're working in the jail and juvenile hall and with people reentering our community after incarcerations. We have reentry services as well and sober living homes. But when you look at restorative justice and the kind of guiding questions, and if you want to kind of compare them to the guiding questions that we can really boil our current system down to, we're looking at the criminal justice system as asking what law was broken, first and foremost, who did it, and what do they deserve? What punishment can right that wrong? Whereas restorative justice, first and foremost, says who was harmed? Who's our victim? And then two, what are their needs? What does that person need for this to be resolved or for it to be addressed, for the harm to be addressed? And then finally, the third question, really, whose obligations are these needs? Who's responsible? And that doesn't necessarily only implicate one offender or a group of direct offenders, but potentially the entire community or our society at large has some responsibility or some obligations, not only to the victim, but to the offender. And so that's where restorative justice, I would say, restorative partners has kind of engage the restorative justice approach from the when we started in 2011 is looking at that last question, whose obligation is this? And we find that the stakeholdership is much wider than just the offender or just the state.
So can you give almost a direct example of how this restorative justice process would work between an offender and a victim?
Yeah, so victim-offender dialoguing or victim-offender mediation is the kind of common way that that can happen if you have a direct, like a victim and an offender who are both willing. First, it has to be victim-driven, so the victim has to bring this to the table and be willing and wanting. And then likewise, the offender has to be willing and wanting and be deemed capable and able to engage in this conversation without causing further harm. And so the way that it works is the victim has a lot of support and opportunity to kind of start processing and preparing for a dialogue. Likewise, the offender has that same preparation, and this can happen over incredibly long periods of time, whatever it takes for that specific case. And then ultimately, when they're ready, if they've chosen to do a direct dialogue, then they can come together with the mediation and support of restorative justice workers and mediators. Or there can never be a face-to-face, and there can be something kind of indirect and mediated.
And so what is the long-term hope then, that the healing for the victim and being able to be heard? Or, you know, like what is the vision of the healing that happens then for both the victim and the offender and maybe even the community at large? And let's specifically if it's a robbery or an assault.
So in that case, you know, for the victim, I think in general for the victim to be able to ask questions and get clarity and state their needs, get back to that question. What are my needs for reparation, for reconciliation?
So how can the victim feel whole once again?
If that's even, you know, if that's possible, I think generally for victims, that's probably not necessarily the goal. It could be the outcome is that there's some sort of wholeness. But I think the goal really is more to be able to get a clearer understanding of what happened, why it happened, what were the implications, what was the impact for both sides to be able to have a clearer understanding of the human on the other side of the gun or the other side of the robbery or the other side of that experience.
And then for the offender, the healing would be in being able to ask for forgiveness or for to apologize or to be able to make amends in some way. I'm not sure what the word is.
Yeah. I think for the offender, we work much more with the offender. And so my experience has been it's interesting you use the word forgiveness, because it's not really a goal of restorative partners. Could be a byproduct, or restorative justice, excuse me, could be a byproduct, but not really the goal. But I've found so often in my own, when I've harmed others or been harmed, and then likewise in my work at the jail and the juvenile hall, has been much more about self-forgiveness. That there's an opportunity to look at, rather than what's wrong with me, what happened to me, and then what has my life, you know, what have I done, or what have been some of the choices I've made, or what am I accountable for? And then likewise, asking the same questions that the victim gets to ask: what are my needs, and whose obligations are those? Because more often than not, in a vast way, offenders are victims before they've ever offended anyone.
You're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest is Olivia Lopez. She is from Restorative Partners, and we're kind of working our way through the story of Olivia's life and restorative justice and how that looks. And we'll return to take your calls in a moment. Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875. Is this Ash?
Yes.
Hi, you're on the air. What's on your mind today?
39 years ago, there was a lady who found herself pregnant and made the assumption that she was pregnant from a previous boyfriend and not her current mate. So she made the decision to put the child up for adoption. And I adopted him, knowing nothing about her, when he was 2 days old. And I raised the young man. And he was a wonderful, wonderful person. When he was about 19, we did a little research work and were able to locate her. And it did not go that well. The truth of the matter probably is the man that fathered him was her current husband. So my son got cheated out of his childhood because her children looked like the spitting image of my son on Facebook. And obviously that's the case for many reasons based on when we spoke with her originally. So there's the issue that, and my question is now directed with that background to Olivia: how would she feel or deal with, or does she know who her biological parents are? How would she embrace that?
I don't know if you're comfortable going with that. That's your choice. Olivia, thank you, Ash, for calling in.
Yeah, sure. I don't mind answering that. I do actually know my biological parents, both of them. I met my mother when I was 14. It was an open adoption, so she had contact with my parents my entire childhood. And then my father I found when I was 17. He had wanted to keep me, so he thought open adoption would be too painful. And then we circled back around when we were both able and ready. So I know both of them, and I think restorative justice, ironically, is a big part of my life, my personal life, in that way. I'm still definitely processing the implications of that decision. So
to be able to
answer it.
Well, I know, and thank you. I hope that helps a little, Ash. And I think that kind of brings me to the thought I was having when I listened to you speak yesterday about restorative justice. And are these principles something we could apply to our own family work? Because as a family therapist, you know, family conflicts are incredibly painful and difficult to navigate as a therapist and as the people within the family system, because we're depending on these people for love and acceptance, right, and safety and home. And at the same time, we can be so filled with anger and frustration with them that they can be our greatest enemy. And so to try to live with that dichotomy within the family, that these conflicts, you know, they vary from brief disagreements, you know, that we kind of forget about and go on and on. But then there can be, you know, these years of emotional conflict or even physical conflicts that cause long-term pain and suffering in both people. Because when we find ourselves in a family system or in a violent or emotionally abusive relationship within our family, you know, both the parties end up feeling wronged. You know, both people feel justified in their anger and their defensiveness or their lashing out or attacking. We tend to, want to protect our own self. So we lash out and use you statements and blame. And so when it finally comes to a head or a point where maybe they come into counseling, what so often happens is that the challenge is in helping both people understand that they both have been wounded, mm-hmm. right? Because each person believes that they're the victim. But to somehow help them understand they both have been wounded and they both have been the offenders in some way. And then the process of trying to have someone, and it's interesting because generally one person has been more traumatized in the family dynamic than the other. And if the person who's been more traumatized can initiate a conversation about, here's what's happened for me, and I want to apologize for what I've done to you, but I want us to move forward. That's a leap of courage and faith that's hard to get to in families, but that seems to be kind of the key steps that has to happen, that someone has to be willing to break the cycle and offer an apology and also own their piece of it, right? To own how they were part of the conflict and part of the wounding. And then ultimately what I find so fascinating, you mentioned the thing about forgiveness. Forgiveness is a loaded word because we can't always come to this spiritual place of forgiveness. In many ways, we just find a way to move forward with the knowledge of having hurt each other and wanting it to be better. And then that piece of trying to restore our own self-worth. So I'm trying not to make it too complicated, but I guess the end piece was that when two people have been wounded, when two people have suffered or have been traumatized or been victims together in their own relationship, they both have suffered a loss of their own sense of self-worth. And part of that response to that lack of self-worth or self-esteem is to lash out at others, right? To want to victimize them or to hurt them back or to get revenge, which never really fills that sense of loss and self-worth. And so in this kind of restorative justice way of doing family therapy, the idea is to help the person who's been victimized find other ways to redeem their self-worth by volunteering, you know, working in a place like Restorative Partners or working in a women's shelter or volunteering for the environment, doing something that intrinsically lifts their sense of self-worth. And when they get to a place of feeling whole, maybe not whole, but healthy again, they can re-engage in a relationship with those family members. I mean, it's a long process, and not many families have the patience to do that.
And or the resources for the support to make that happen. It's interesting you talk about relationships, because in restorative justice, the kind of definition of crime or wrongdoing or harm done is a disruption in relationship. Mm-hmm. So whether you're talking about kind of a wider community disruption, or whether you're talking about, like you said, in interpersonal relationships, in our family relationships, our friendships, our partnerships, that kind of disruption in our relationship and a kind of a breakage in the relationship. And so then likewise, the healing part, I think it's interesting. I just read something, a woman we're bringing in October named Jean Bishop. She writes the book Change of Heart, Justice, Mercy, and Making Peace with My Sister's Killer. She, in the kind of, synopsis of the book or whatever, the summary of the book, she asks the question, what is your relationship to the offender? And I think that that kind of is an interesting way to look at both kind of wrongdoing and healing from wrongdoing, is what is your relationship to the offender? And looking at the relationship and understanding the relationship and the connection between the two parties as being kind of the site for healing opportunities. So like we were talking about before, what's the goal? The goal is to recognize your relationship with that person, because invariably a victim and offender, whether they're husband and wife and it's in the minutiae of day to day, or whether it's a rape victim and her rapist, we're looking at that person now you know, for better or for worse, is in relationship with, mm-hmm. and how to...
Your lives have intersected in a way now that makes it inevitable that you have to face that relationship, whatever it was, in order to move forward.
Right.
And the idea, and I like this, you know, the visual, this idea that the victim has power because they can do the work to restore their self-worth and sense of well-being by doing other work that empowers them, or to become more educated, to increase their sense of competency or mastery in life. That instead of waiting, the apology and the forgiveness of the offender is one piece, but for the victim to then actually do their own advocacy for their self-worth is huge in mm-hmm. healing. Our number is 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. My guest is Olivia Lopez, and we're talking about restorative justice and her work with restorative partners. And at the beginning of the show, I'd also mentioned, you know, when I was thinking about all the ways that I see restorative justice principles kind of helping us move closer together, you know, this theme of community, that for better or worse, we're all in this community, and we seek that community. People come to places, small towns or communities, because they feel like they have a better opportunity to network or get to know their neighbors or get to know their fellow citizens. And then when something happens that divides it, and for example, the election and what we're seeing with people taking to the streets and other people who were, you know, excited for the change, feeling befuddled as to how there could be such a divide. How do you imagine we could use these social justice principles? Like, how could we start? Because we've talked a lot about needing to heal the divide or start conversations. In your experience, you know, how would we start to utilize those principles in a community sense around this?
Well, like,
I know.
I think, I guess I have to relate it back to my intrapersonal work, and that until I could approach the othered parts of myself, until I approach the othered parts of myself, I can't really start to kind of, if we're going to use the word whole, I can't move towards wholeness if I'm not acknowledging that part of me that is adopted and says I'm not worthy of love, and look at that and hold that and see what that is, or the any other parts of myself that I've rejected. I can't move forward. And so I think,
or acknowledging the parts of us that is capable of wounding others,
right,
the part of us that is capable of having thoughts or actions that would not be in the best interest of the community, right, accepting that we all carry that capacity.
Right. And so I think it's the same kind of interpersonal work as well, to kind of approach the people that we think are other, or the people that we think are causing this pain and suffering, to be able to somehow approach, and the willingness to listen and understand we are in relationship with one another. And so what is our relationship to the other?
Or our responsibility to one another.
Yeah. What's our responsibility? Are we willing to acknowledge that there's even a linkage between our, you know, the members in our community across that political divide or social divide or any other divisions that we've created? I don't know if that.
Well, because I think the reason there hasn't been a simple answer, the reason we don't just, you know, have a town hall meeting and everyone come together and share our experiences, because it's much more loaded than that. You know, and I guess that's my understanding of restorative justice, is that there has to be a willingness on both parties' part to have the conversation. But is apology necessary? Because that keeps going through my head. You know, I keep reading in the tenets, you know, there has to be an apology, an initiation of the apology. So are we hoping that those who are happy with the direction the country is going in are going to apologize for the direction the country is going in? I wonder how that begins. Or is it enough for, you know, both parties feel wounded? What's the first step? As I mentioned, in family systems, someone has to break the negative cycle and step forward and say, you know, my relationship or my community means more to me than the personal suffering I'm experiencing right now. So I'm going to step out of my suffering and try to approach you.
I think there has to be a willingness, like you said, a willingness to even engage in the conversation, to recognize that potentially, like you said, we're not just victims, or we're not just victorious. We also potentially are causing grave harm. And then to look at, okay, well, what are my responsibilities, my individual responsibilities? Yeah, I wanted this, that, and the next thing to happen when I elected this person, but I didn't want this, that, or the next thing. Well, let's look at then. Let's look at what we're responsible for when we make these decisions.
And then on the other hand, for those who feel wounded by the election results, what would be their culpability? What would be, you know, is it?
I think a lot about that as a educated white woman, mm-hmm. And looking at the statistics of who voted and in my demographic, and feeling really disappointed and angry and frustrated and confused. And then also thinking, you know, it's really convenient to separate myself from that 53% of white women, educated women who did vote this way, and, you know, that I do feel wronged by in a way. It's convenient to say, well, they're other too.
So I wonder how we go about, you know, forming these community circles, somewhat in the ways that you do in the jail or in the juvenile hall system, these circles of community and conversation. I wonder how we go about forming those, you know, how we bring them together. It's small groups, because large groups tend to get that mob mentality and people separate, but smaller groups who are kind of wanting to reach across and figure out what is the common good, or what are those things that we can agree on and move forward with. And I think about the same thing with the family systems, you know, in families that have been completely divided by emotional trauma or physical abuse within the home, or, you know, just years of neglect. How do we create a space that's safe enough within that family for both, you know, people who feel they've been harmed to realize they were offenders as well as victims?
There's a wonderful program that we do called the Alternatives to Violence Project, and it's done at the California Men's Colony, out at the Slo County Jail as well, Grizzly Youth Academy at the Juvenile Hall, and in our community. And it's something that's done internationally. It was started by the Quakers, and I think that it provides a really ripe container for the kind of process, restorative justice process. One, it's circle-based, so, you know, everyone is in a circle for about 20 hours of a workshop.
Wow.
So you have this opportunity to sit physically in an equitable stance, where every part of the circle is just as important as the next, and each part of the circle makes the circle. It's necessary. And then the opportunity within that is to engage both, just, I think we talked about it towards the beginning, just in the kind of, what's your favorite food, or what's your favorite childhood memory, or, you know, what's something that's not readily apparent about you, and engage in that way. And then turn around and, you know, throw Beanie Babies in a game called Pattern Ball, and you know, pretend like we're not adults for a moment. And then to touch into deeper parts of ourselves, those kind of wounded parts that we can all know viscerally. And that, I think, is a wonderful way to engage people across lines. And we do that with people on the outside, people coming from the outside, and then people who are incarcerated currently. Both sides are participants, both sides are facilitators, coming together to spend that 20 hours at least engaging in those conversations, starting to recognize our own humanity and then the others.
So that, I like the idea of starting with just those things that make us feel, the things that we love and care about, our animals or our favorite foods or music, is a great non-threatening way to start these conversations with anyone, to kind of to talk about those things that join us in the experience of being alive, and then to move to the deeper things. And I wonder how it would be, you know, how powerful it would be to sit and I would like to hear someone tell me all the ways that, you know, and be able to look me in the eye and all the ways that this election is important to them, or their hopes moving forward, or, you know, how our behavior, either whether it's marching or protesting, hurts them. You know, to be able to sit and hear that, just as in family therapy, you know, one of the most powerful things is to get the family members in the room and to have them be able to sit and hear without getting defensive, without lashing out, without getting angry, but to just sit and hear the ways that they hurt or harmed their family members, and to be able to take that in, that opens the doors for being able to move forward. Because if both parties are willing to have the courage to sit and hear the pain that they've caused another person, and then the other person is willing to hear that same story without defense, then it opens some doors. And again, that question of forgiveness, if we take that off the table and really hope more for reconciliation, how does that look in the end? How do people move forward? Do they end up becoming best friends? You know, do we have that storybook movie ending? Or is it just an acceptance of mutual need as a community that we make space for each other? What is the happy ending? Or, you know, what does that look like?
I don't know. Again, I have to come back to my own life. I've never, you know, run a workshop for a nation of people who are discontented and confused. I think for me and my own work and my on my trauma and my life, I feel like I keep coming back to, I can't do that with you unless I can do it with me. Mm-hmm. And so I think it looks like probably the willingness on all sides to kind of do our individual work. I don't know how to say it in a different way that sounds less cheesy and like, yeah, go see a
you're
therapist.
You're in a therapist
go
room
see a
right
therapist.
Now. You're in a
That's
therapist
what I would
room.
Say. Go see a trauma-informed therapist.
Yeah. Well, and really there's a whole specialty around that. And there is probably a lot of work that could be done with good therapy at this time. So as we finish up, can you just, if people are interested in getting involved with Restorative Partners, because I know you operate with a lot of volunteers, how do they get in contact with you and find out more about the opportunities?
So you can go on to our website, restorativepartners.org, or you can go ahead and email me directly. That's olivia@restorativepartners.org. And we have volunteer orientations about every 4 to 6 weeks. So if you just reach out with an email or through our website, we can get you connected to that volunteer training and then get you started towards the clearance process to come into the jail and juvenile hall and work in our programming. The other huge way for people who are not wanting to go into a locked facility potentially, or that they're just called to do some work out in the community, is our mentorship program. So we connect, and I think coming back to this web, I think this is kind of where the rubber meets the road, is when community members are willing to walk the journey with people. So we connect people for about a year of a relationship that's voluntary on both sides for someone in the community to support someone coming out of incarceration through that first year of reentry.
So that one-on-one support and that one-on-one connection kind of makes that healing have a face.
Exactly.
That community feeling have a face.
And the ripple effect of that face, because that face is connected potentially to a lot of other faces, and kind of the doors that opens just interpersonally and in terms of relationships and feeling like you belong. You were exiled and now you can come back.
We welcome you.
Yeah.
Restorative Partners, an organization, a nonprofit that helps heal all those impacted by crime, utilizing the principles of restorative justice. Olivia Lopez, thank you so much for coming in the spur of the moment, being my guest, sharing your story and your heart. And thank you for listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. You can podcast our show through iTunes. Just search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You can always send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com or join us on Facebook, The Reluctant Therapist. As always, I appreciate you supporting public radio, KCBX.
Whoa. Oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be. No. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Oh, mercy, mercy me. Mercy. Oh, things ain't what they used to be. No. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. Our things ain't what they used to be. Lost my radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby are lies. Mercy, mercy me.
Mercy,
all things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more be you from me? Can't you stand it?